Chapter 9. "You certainly will not deny," Gavril Ardalionovitch began, directly addressing Budovsky, who was listening to him intently, and obviously in violent agitation, his eyes round with wonder. "You will not attempt, and will not wish seriously to deny, that you were born just 2 years after your worthy mother was legally married to Mr. Budovsky, your father. The date of your birth can be too easily proved, so that the distortion of this fact, so insulting to you and your mother, in Mr. Keller's article, must be ascribed simply to the playfulness of Mr. Keller's own imagination. He no doubt supposed he was making your claim stronger by this statement, and so promoting your interest. Mr. Keller says that he read some of the article to you beforehand, but not the whole of it. There can be no doubt that he did not read so far as that passage."
"No, I didn't, as a fact," the boxer interrupted. "But all the facts were given me by a competent person."
"Excuse me, Mr. Keller," interposed Gavril Ardalionovitch. "Allow me to speak. I assure you your article will have its turn later, and then you can make your explanation. But now we had better take things in their proper order. Quite by chance, with the help of my sister, Varvara Ardalionovna Titsin, I obtained from her intimate friend, Madame Zubkov, a widow lady who has an estate in the country, a letter written to her by the late Mr. Pavlishchov from abroad, 24 years ago. Making Madame Zubkov's acquaintance, I applied, at her suggestion, to a distant relation who was in his day a great friend of Mr. Pavlishchov, the retired Colonel Vyazovkin. I succeeded in getting from him two more letters of Mr. Pavlishchov's, also written from abroad. From these three letters, from the facts and dates mentioned in them, it can be positively proved beyond all possibility of doubt or dispute that he had gone abroad just a year and a half before you were born, Mr. Budovsky, and that he remained abroad for 3 years. Your mother, as you know, has never been out of Russia. For the present, I will not read these letters. It's late now. I simply announce the fact. But if you care to fix a time to see me tomorrow morning, if you like, Mr. Budovsky, and bring your witnesses, as many as you please, and experts to examine the handwriting, I have no doubt that you cannot but be convinced of the obvious truth of the facts I have laid before you. If this is so, the whole case, of course, falls to the ground and is over." Again, general commotion and intense excitement followed. Budovsky himself suddenly got up from his chair.
"If it's so, I've been deceived. Deceived not by Cherbarov, but long, long before. I don't want any experts. I don't want to see you. I believe you. I withdraw my claim. I won't agree to the 10,000. Goodbye."
He took up his cap and pushed away his chair to go out.
"If you can, Mr. Budovsky..."
Gavril Ardalionovitch stopped him softly and sweetly. "Stay another 5 minutes. Some other extremely important facts have come to light in this case. For you, at any rate, they are very interesting. To my thinking, you should not remain in ignorance of them, and perhaps it will be pleasanter for you if the case can be completely cleared up." Budovsky sat down without speaking, with his head bowed, seemingly lost in thought. The Lebediev's nephew, who had got up to follow him, sat down too. Though he had not lost his self-possession and his boldness, he seemed greatly perplexed. Ippolit was scowling, dejected, and apparently very much astonished. But at that moment he was coughing so violently that he stained his handkerchief with blood. The boxer was almost in dismay.
"Oh, Antip," he cried bitterly, "I told you at the time, the day before yesterday, that perhaps you really weren't Pavlishchov's son."
There was a sound of smothered laughter. Two or three laughed louder than the rest.
"The fact you stated just now, Mr. Keller," Gavril Ardalionovitch caught him up, "is very valuable. Nevertheless, I have a right to assert, on the most precise evidence, that though Mr. Budovsky, of course, knew very well the date of his birth, he was in complete ignorance of the circumstance of Mr. Pavlishchov's residence abroad, where he spent the greater part of his life, only returning to Russia at brief intervals. Besides, the fact of his going away at that time was not so remarkable as to be remembered 20 years after, even by those who knew Pavlishchov well, to say nothing of Mr. Budovsky, who was not born at the time. It has turned out, of course, not impossible to establish the fact. But I must own that the facts I've collected came to me quite by chance, and might well not have come into my hands, so that this evidence was really almost impossible for Mr. Berdovsky, or even Cherbaroff, to obtain, even if they had thought of obtaining it. But they may well not have thought of it.
"Allow me, Mr. Ivolgin,"
Ippolit suddenly interrupted irritably.
"What's all this bobbery for, if I may ask? The case has been cleared up. We agree to accept the most important fact. Why drag out a tedious and offensive rigmarole about it? You want perhaps to brag of your cleverness in investigation, to display before us and the prince what a fine detective you are? Or are you undertaking to excuse and justify Mr. Berdovsky by proving that he got mixed up in this business through ignorance? But that's impudence, sir. Berdovsky has no need of your apologies and your justification, let me tell you. It's painful for him. It's trying for him. Anyway, he is in an awkward position. You ought to see that and understand it."
"Enough, Mr. Terentyev, enough," Gavril Ardalionovitch succeeded in interrupting. "Be calm and don't excite yourself. I'm afraid you are not at all well. I feel for you. If you like, I've finished. Or rather, I am obliged to state briefly only those facts which I am convinced it would be a good thing to know in full detail," he added, noticing a general movement suggestive of impatience. "I only want to state, with proofs, for the information of all that are interested, that Mr. Pavlichtchov bestowed so much kindness and care on your mother, Mr. Berdovsky, only because she was the sister of a serf girl with whom Mr. Pavlichtchov was in love in his early youth, and so much so that he would certainly have married her if she had not died suddenly. I have proofs that this perfectly true and certain fact is very little known, or perhaps quite forgotten. Further, I could inform you how your mother was taken by Pavlichtchov at 10 years old and brought up by him as though she had been a relation, that she had a considerable dowry set apart for her, and that the trouble he took about her gave rise to extremely disquieting rumours among Pavlichtchov's numerous relations. It was even thought that he was going to marry his ward, but it ended by her marrying in her 20th year by her own choice, and that I can prove in a most certain way, a surveying clerk called Berdovsky. I have collected some well-authenticated facts to prove that your father, Mr. Berdovsky, who was anything but a businessman, gave up his post on receiving your mother's dowry of 15,000 rubles, entered upon commercial speculations, was deceived, lost his capital, took to drink to drown his grief, and fell ill in consequence, and finally died prematurely, 8 years after marrying your mother. Then, according to your mother's own testimony, she was left utterly destitute, and would have come to grief entirely, if it had not been for the constant and generous assistance of Mr. Pavlichtchov, who allowed her 600 rubles a year. There is ample evidence, too, that he was extremely fond of you as a child. From this evidence, and from what your mother tells me, it seems that he was fond of you chiefly because you looked like a wretched, miserable child, and had the appearance of a cripple, and could not speak plainly. And, as I have learnt on well-authenticated evidence, Pavlichtchov had all his life a specially tender feeling for everything afflicted and unfairly treated by nature, particularly children, a fact of great importance in our case, to my thinking. Finally, I can boast of having found out a fact of prime importance. That is, that this extreme fondness of Pavlichtchov for you, by his efforts you were admitted to the gymnasium and taught under special supervision, little by little led the relations of Pavlichtchov and the members of his household to imagine that you were his son, and that your father was deceived by his wife. But it's noteworthy that this idea only grew into a general conviction in the latter years of Pavlichtchov's life, when all his relations were alarmed about his will, and when the original facts were forgotten, and it was impossible to investigate them. No doubt that idea came to your ears too, Mr. Berdovsky, and took complete possession of you. Your mother, whose acquaintance I've had the honour of making, knew of these rumours, but to this day she does not know—I concealed it from her too— that you, her son, were dominated by this idea. I found your much-respected mother, Mr. Podovsky, in Pskov, ill and extremely poor, as she has been ever since the death of Pavlishchov. She told me with tears of gratitude that she was only supported by you and your help. She expects a great deal of you in the future, and believes earnestly in your future success.
This is really insupportable, Lebedev's nephew exclaimed loudly and impatiently. What's the object of this romance?
It's disgusting, it's unseemly, said Ippolit with an abrupt movement.
But Podovsky noticed nothing and did not stir. What's the object of it? What's it for? Said Gavriil Ardalionovitch with sly wonder, maliciously preparing for his conclusion. Why? In the first place, Mr. Podovsky is perhaps now fully convinced that Mr. Pavlishchov loved him from generosity and not as his son. This fact alone it was essential that Mr. Podovsky should know, since he upheld Mr. Keller and approved of him when his article was read just now. I say this because I look upon you as an honourable man, Mr. Podovsky. In the second place, it appears that there was not the least intention of robbery or swindling in the case, even in Cherbarov. That's an important point for me, too, because the prince, speaking warmly just now, mentioned that I shared his opinion of the dishonest and swindling element in the case. On the contrary, there was absolute faith in it on all sides, and though Cherbarov may really be a great rogue, in this case he appears as nothing worse than a sharp and scheming attorney. He hoped to make a good deal out of it, as a lawyer, and his calculation was not only acute and masterly, it was absolutely safe. It was based on the readiness with which the prince gives away his money, and his gratitude and respect for Pavlishchov, and what is more, on the prince's well-known chivalrous views as to the obligations of honour and conscience. As for Mr. Podovsky, personally, one may even say that, thanks to certain ideas of his, he was so worked upon by Cherbarov and his other friends that he took up the case hardly from self-interest, but almost as a service to truth, progress, and humanity. Now, after what I have told you, it has become clear to all that Mr. Podovsky is an innocent man, in spite of all appearances, and the prince, more readily and zealously than before, will offer him his friendly assistance, and that substantial help to which he referred just now, when he spoke of schools and of Pavlishchov.
"Stay, Gavriil Ardalionovitch, stay!" cried Mushkin in genuine dismay, but it was too late. I've told you three times already, cried Podovsky irritably. I don't want the money. I won't take it. I don't want to. I'm going.
And he was almost running out of the veranda, but Lebedev's nephew seized him by the arm and whispered something to him. Podovsky quickly turned back, and pulling a big unsealed envelope out of his pocket, threw it onto a table near Mushkin.
Here's the money. How dared you? How dared you? The money!
The 250 rubles which you dared to send him as a charity by Cherbarov, Doktorenko explained.
The article said 50, cried Kolya.
It's my fault, said Mushkin, going up to Podovsky. I've done you a wrong, Podovsky. But I didn't send it to you as a charity, believe me. I am to blame now. I was to blame before.
Mushkin was much distressed. He looked weak and exhausted, and his words were disconnected.
I talked of swindling, but I didn't mean you. I was mistaken. I said that you were afflicted as I am, but you are not like me. You give lessons, you support your mother. I said that you cast shame on your mother's name, but you love her. She says so herself. I didn't know. Gavriil Ardalionovitch had not told me everything. I am to blame. I ventured to offer you 10,000, but I am to blame. I ought to have done it differently, and now... it can't be done because you despise me.
This is a madhouse, cried Lizaveta Prokofievna.
Of course it's a house of madmen,
Aglaya could not refrain from saying sharply. But her words were lost in the general uproar. All were talking loudly and discussing, some disputing, others laughing. Ivan Fyodorovich Epanchin was roused to the utmost pitch of indignation, and with an air of wounded dignity he waited for Lizaveta Prokofievna. Lebedev's nephew put in the last word.
Yes, Prince, one must do you justice. You do know how to make use of your, well, illness, to express it politely. You've managed to offer your friendship and money in such an ingenious way that now it's impossible for an honourable man to take it under any circumstances. That's either a bit too innocent or a bit too clever. You know best which.
"Excuse me, gentlemen," cried Gavril Ardilionovitch, who had meantime opened the envelope. "There are not 250 roubles here. There's only 100. I say so, Prince, that there may be no misunderstanding."
"Well, let it be! Let it be!"
cried Mushkin, waving his hands at Gavril Ardilionovitch.
"No! Don't let it be!"
Lebedev's nephew caught it up at once.
"Your let it be is an insult to us, Prince. We don't hide ourselves. We declare it openly. Yeah! There are only 100 roubles in it, instead of 250. But isn't it just the same?"
"No, it's not just the same,"
Gavril Ardilionovitch managed to interpolate, with an air of naive perplexity.
"Don't interrupt me! We're not such fools as you think, Mr. Lawyer," cried Lebedev's nephew with spiteful vexation. "Of course 100 roubles is not 250, and it's not just the same, but the principle is what matters. The initiative is the great thing, and that 150 roubles are missing is only a detail. What matters is that Badovsky does not accept your charity, Your Excellency, that he throws it in your face, and in that sense it makes no difference whether it's 100 or 250. Badovsky hasn't accepted the 10,000, as you've seen. He wouldn't have brought back the 100 roubles if he had been dishonest. That 150 roubles has gone to Cherbarov for his journey to see the prince. You may laugh at our awkwardness, at our inexperience in business. You've tried your very utmost to make us ridiculous, but don't dare to say we are dishonest. We'll all club together, sir, to pay back that 150 roubles to the prince. We'll pay it back if it has to be a rouble at a time, and we'll pay it back with interest. Badovsky is poor. Badovsky hasn't millions, and Cherbarov sent in his account after his journey. We hope to win the case. Who would not have done the same thing in his place?"
"Who would not?" exclaimed Prince S.
"I shall go out of my mind here," cried Madame Epanchin.
"It reminds me," laughed Yevgeny Pavlovich, who had long been standing there watching, "of the celebrated defence made recently by a lawyer, who, bringing forward in justification the poverty of his client as an excuse for his having murdered and robbed 6 people at once, suddenly finished up with something like this. 'It was natural,' said he, 'that in my client's poverty, the idea of murdering 6 people should have occurred to him. And to whom, indeed, would it not have occurred in his position?'"
"There's something of that sort, very amusing."
"Enough!"
Lizaveta Prokofievna announced suddenly, almost shaking with anger.
"It's time to cut short this nonsense."
She was in terrible excitement. She flung back her head menacingly, and with flashing eyes and an air of haughty, fierce, and impatient defiance, she scanned the whole party, scarcely able at the moment to distinguish between friends and foes. She had reached that pitch of long-suppressed, but at last irrepressible wrath, when the craving for immediate conflict, for immediate attack on someone, becomes the leading impulse. Those who knew Madame Epanchin felt at once that something unusual had happened to her. Ivan Fyodorovitch told Prince S. next day that
"she has these attacks sometimes, but such a pitch as yesterday is unusual even with her. It happens to her once in 3 years or so, but not oftener. Not oftener," he added emphatically.
"Enough, Ivan Fyodorovitch! Let me alone!"
cried Lizaveta Prokofievna.
"Why are you offering me your arm now? You hadn't the sense to take me away before. You are the husband. You are the head of the family. You ought to have taken me by the ear and led me out if I was so silly as not to obey you and go. You might think of your daughters anyhow. Now we can find the way without you. I've had shame enough to last me a year. Wait a bit. I must still thank the prince. Thank you for your entertainment, prince. I've been staying on to listen to the young people. It's disgraceful, disgraceful. It's chaos, infamy. It's worse than a dream. Are there many like them? Be quiet, Aglaia. Be quiet, Alexandra. It's not your business. Don't fuss around me. Yevgeny Pavlovich, you bother me. So you are asking their forgiveness, my dear," she went on, addressing Mushkin again. "It's my fault," says he, "for daring to offer you a fortune. And what are you pleased to be laughing at, you braggart?" She pounced suddenly on Lebedev's nephew.
We refuse the fortune, says he. We demand. We don't ask. As though he didn't know that this idiot will trail off tomorrow to them to offer his friendship and his money to them again. You will, won't you? You will. Will you or not?
I shall, said Mushkin in a soft and humble voice.
You hear? So that's what you are reckoning on?
She turned again to Doktorenko.
The money is as good as in your pocket. That's why you boast and try to impress us. No, my good man, you can find other fools. I see through you. I see all your game. Lizaveta Prokofievna,
cried Mushkin. Come away, Lizaveta Prokofievna. It's time we went, and let us take the prince with us, Prince S. said, smiling as calmly as he could. The girl stood on one side, almost scared. General Panshin was genuinely alarmed. Everyone present was amazed. Some of those standing furthest away whispered together and smiled on the sly. Lebediev's face wore an expression of perfect rapture.
"There's chaos and infamy to be found everywhere, madam,"
said Lebediev's nephew, though he was a good deal disconcerted.
"But not so bad. Not so bad as yours, my man," Lizaveta Prokofievna retorted with almost hysterical vindictiveness. "Let me alone!" she cried to those who tried to persuade her. "Well, since you yourself, Yevgeny Pavlovich, have just told us that even a lawyer in court declared that nothing is more natural if one is poor than to butcher six people, it simply means the end of all things. I never heard of such a thing. It's all clear now. And this stuttering fellow, wouldn't he murder anyone?"
She pointed to Bedovsky, who was gazing at her in extreme bewilderment.
"I am ready to bet that he will murder someone. Maybe he won't take your money, your 10,000. Maybe he won't take it for conscience' sake. But he'll come at night and murder you and take the money out of your cash box. He'll take it for conscience' sake. That's not dishonest to him. It's just an outburst of noble indignation. It's a protest, or goodness knows what. Tfu! Everything is topsy-turvy. Everything is upside down. A girl grows up at home, and suddenly in the middle of the street she jumps into a cab. Mother, I was married the other day to some Karlich or Ivanich. Goodbye. And is it the right thing to behave like that, do you think? Is it natural? Is it deserving of respect? The woman question. This silly boy," she pointed to Kolya. "Even he was arguing the other day that that's what the woman question means. Even though the mother was a fool, you must behave like a human being to her. Why did you come in tonight with your heads in the air? Make way! We are coming! Give us every right, and don't you dare breathe a word before us. Pay us every sort of respect, such as no one's heard of, and we shall treat you worse than the lowest lackey. They strive for justice. They stand on their rights, and yet they've slandered him like infidels in their article. We demand, we don't ask, and you will get no gratitude from us, because you are acting for the satisfaction of your own conscience. Queer sort of reasoning. Why, if he'll get no gratitude from you, the prince may tell you in answer that he feels no gratitude to Pavlishchev, because Pavlishchev, too, did good for the satisfaction of his own conscience. And you know it's just his gratitude to Pavlishchev you've been reckoning on. He has not borrowed money from you. He doesn't owe you anything. So what are you reckoning on, if not his gratitude? So how can you repudiate it? Lunatics! They regard society as savage and inhuman because it cries shame on the seduced girl. But if you think society inhuman, you must think that the girl suffers from the censure of society. And if she does, how is it you expose her to society in the newspapers and expect her not to suffer? Lunatics! Vain creatures! They don't believe in God. They don't believe in Christ. Why, you are so eaten up with pride and vanity that you'll end by eating up one another. That's what I prophesy. Isn't that topsy-turvydom? Isn't that chaos? Isn't it infamy? And after that, this disgraceful creature must needs go and beg their pardon, too. Are there many more like you? What are you laughing at? At my disgracing myself with you? Why, I've disgraced myself already. There's no help for it now. Don't you go grinning, you sweep! She pounced on Ippolit. He is almost at his last gasp, yet he is corrupting others. You've corrupted this silly boy, she pointed to Kolya again. He does nothing but rave about you. You teach him atheism. You don't believe in God, and you are not too old for a whipping yourself, sir! Fie upon you! So, you'll go to them tomorrow, Prince Leov Nikolaevich, she asked the prince again, almost breathless. Yes, but I don't want to know you.
She turned quickly to go out, but at once turned back again.
And you'll go to this atheist, too?" She pointed to Ippolit. "How dare you laugh at me!" she cried in an unnatural scream, and darted at Ippolit, unable to endure his sarcastic grin. "Lizaveta Prokofievna! Lizaveta Prokofievna! Lizaveta Prokofievna!" was heard on all sides at once. "Mammon, this is shameful!" Aglaya cried aloud.
"Don't worry yourself, Aglaya Ivanovna,"
Ippolit answered calmly. Lizaveta Prokofievna had dashed up to him and had seized him by the arm, and for some inexplicable reason was still holding it tight. She stood before him, her wrathful eyes fastened upon his.
"Don't worry yourself. Your mammon will see that she cannot attack a dying man. I am ready to explain why I laughed. I shall be very glad of permission to do so."
Here he coughed terribly, and could not leave off for a full minute.
"He's dying, that he must hold forth," cried Lizaveta Prokofievna, letting go his arm and looking almost with horror at the blood he wiped from his lips. "You are not fit for talking. You simply ought to go and lie down."
"So I shall,"
Ippolit answered in a low, husky voice, almost a whisper.
"As soon as I get home today, I'll go to bed. In another fortnight I shall die, as I know. B.N. himself told me so a week ago. So that if you allow me, I should like to say two words to you at parting."
"Are you crazy? Nonsense! You want nursing. It's not the time to talk. Go along to go to bed,"
Lizaveta Prokofievna cried in horror.
"If I go to bed, I shan't get up again till I die,"
said Ippolit, smiling.
"I was thinking of going to bed and not getting up again yesterday, but I decided to put it off till the day after tomorrow, since I still could stand on my legs, so as to come here with them today. Only I am awfully tired."
"Sit down. Sit down. Why are you standing? Here's a chair."
Lizaveta Prokofievna flew up to him and set a chair for him herself.
"Thank you,"
Ippolit went on softly.
"And you sit down opposite and we can talk. We must have a talk, Lizaveta Prokofievna. I insist on it now."
He smiled at her again.
"Think, this is the last time I shall be out in the air and with people. And in a fortnight I shall certainly be underground, so that this will be like a farewell to men and to nature. Though I am not very sentimental, yet, would you believe it, I am awfully glad that all this has happened at Pavlovsk. One can see the trees in leaf, anyway."
"You can't talk now,"
said Lizaveta Prokofievna, growing more and more alarmed.
"You are in a perfect fever. You were screeching and squeaking before, and now you can scarcely breathe. You are gasping."
"I shall be better in a minute. Why do you want to refuse my last wish? Do you know, I have been dreaming of making your acquaintance for a long time, Lizaveta Prokofievna. I have heard a great deal about you from Kolya. He is almost the only one who hasn't given me up. You are an original woman, an eccentric woman. I've seen that for myself now. Do you know that I was rather fond of you even?
Good heavens! And I was positively on the point of striking him."
"Aglaya Ivanovna held you back. I'm not mistaken, am I? This is your daughter, Aglaya Ivanovna. She is so beautiful that I guessed who she was at first sight, though I'd never seen her. Let me at least look at a beautiful woman for the last time in my life."
Ippolit smiled a sort of awkward, wry smile.
"Here. The prince is here, and your husband, and the whole party. Why do you refuse my last wish?"
"A chair!"
cried Lizaveta Prokofievna. But she seized one herself and sat down opposite Ippolit.
"Kolya," she commanded, "you must go with him. Take him, and tomorrow I'll certainly go myself."
"If you allow me, I would ask the prince for a cup of tea. I'm very tired. Do you know, Lizaveta Prokofievna, I believe you meant to take the prince back to tea with you. Stay here instead. Let us spend the time together, and I am sure the prince will give us all tea. Excuse my arranging it all, but I know you are good-natured. The prince is good-natured, too. We are all ridiculously good-natured people."
Mushkin made haste to give orders. Lebediev flew headlong out of the room. Vera ran after him,
That's true,
Madame Epanchin decided abruptly.
Talk, only quietly. Don't get excited. You've softened my heart. Prince, you don't deserve that I should drink tea with you, but so be it, I'll stay. Though I am not going to apologize to anyone. Not to anyone. It's nonsense. Still, if I've abused you, Prince, forgive me. As you like, though. But I'm not keeping anyone.
She turned with an expression of extraordinary wrath to her husband and daughters, as though they had treated her disgracefully.
I can find my way home alone.
But they didn't let her finish. They all drew up around her readily. Mushkin at once began pressing everyone to stay to tea, and apologized for not having thought of it before. Even General Epanchin was so amiable as to murmur something reassuring, and asked Lizaveta Prokofievna politely whether it was not too cold for her on the veranda. He almost came to the point of asking Ippolit how long he had been at the university, but he didn't ask him. Yevgeny Pavlovich and Prince S. became suddenly extremely cordial and good-humoured. A look of pleasure began to mingle with astonishment on the faces of Adelaida and Alexandra. In fact, all seemed delighted that Madame Epanchin's paroxysm was over. Only Aglaya still frowned and sat in silence at a little distance. All the rest of the party remained. No one wanted to go away, not even General Ivolgin, to whom, however, Lebediev whispered in passing something, probably not quite pleasant, for the general at once effaced himself in the corner. Mushkin included in his invitation Berdovsky and his friends, without exception. They muttered with a constrained air that they would wait for Ippolit, and at once withdrew to the furthest corner of the veranda, where they sat down all in a row again. Probably the tea had been got ready for Lebediev himself long before, for it was brought in almost immediately. It struck 11.